which had been such an extraordinary survival and check to the Germans that legends grew of supernatural intervention. I was going skiing that week after the meeting with Mr. Scott and took along a suitcase of books to Vermont. I came home with a proposal to do a book on the escape of the Goeben, the German battleship which, by eluding a pursuit by British cruisers in the Mediterranean, had reached Constantinople and brought Turkey, and with it the whole Ottoman Empire of the Middle East, into the war, determining the course of the history of that area from that day to this. The Goeben seemed a natural for me, for it had become family history, which we had witnessed, including myself, at the age of 2. That happened when we too were crossing the Mediterranean en route to Constantinople to visit my grandfather, who was then American ambassador to the port. It was an often-told story in the family circle how the puffs of gun smoke from the pursuing British cruisers were seen from our ship, and how the Goeben put on speed and got away, and how, on arriving at Constantinople, we were the first to bring news to officials and diplomats of the capital of the drama at sea that we had seen. My mother's account of her heavy questioning by the German ambassador before she could even debark or had a chance to greet her father was my first impression, almost at first hand, of the German manner. Almost 30 years later, when I returned from my skiing week in Vermont and told Mr. Scott that this was the story of 1914 that I wanted to write, he said, "No, that was not what he wanted. He was still fixed on Mons. How had the BEF thrown back the Germans? Had they really seen the vision of an angel over the battlefield? And what was the basis of the legend of the Angel of Mons, afterwards so important on the Western Front? Frankly, I was still more interested in the Goeben than in the Angel of Mons, but the fact of a publisher ready for a book on 1914 was more important than either. The war as a whole seemed too large and beyond my capacity. But Mr. Scott kept telling me I could do it, and when I formed the plan of keeping to the war's first month, which contained all the routes, including the Goeben and the Battle of Mons, to make us both happy, the project began to seem feasible. When mired among all those Roman-numeraled corps and left and right flanks, I soon felt out of my depth and felt I should have gone to staff and command school for 10 years before undertaking a book of this kind, especially when trying to tell how the French on the defensive managed to regain Alsace at the very beginning, which I never did understand, but I managed to weave my way in and around it, a manoeuvre one learns in the process of writing history, to muffle the facts a bit when one can't understand everything. Watch Gibbon do it in those sonorous, balanced sentences, which, if you analyse them, often turn out to make little sense, but you forget that in the marvel of their structure. I am no Gibbon, but I have learned the value of venturing into the unfamiliar, instead of returning to a field of previous study, where one already knows the source material and all the persons and circumstances. To do the latter makes the work certainly easier, but removes any sense of discovery and surprise, which is why I like moving to a new subject for a new book. Though it may distress the critics, it pleases me. Since I was hardly known to the critics when The Guns was published, with no reputation for them to enjoy smashing, the book received instead the warmest reception. Clifton Fadiman wrote in the Book of the Month Club Bulletin, "One must be careful with the big words. Still, there is a fair chance that The Guns of August may turn out to be a historical classic. Its virtues are almost Thucydian. Intelligence, concision, weight, detachment." Dealing with the days preceding and following the outbreak of the First World War, its subject, like that of Thucydides, goes beyond the limited scope and reach of the mere narrative. For in hard, sculptured prose, this book fixes the moments that have led inexorably to our own time. It places our dread day in long perspective, arguing that if most of the world's men, women, and children are soon to be burned to atoms, the annihilation would seem to proceed directly out of the mouths of the guns that spoke in August 1914. This may be an oversimplification, but it describes the author's thesis, which she presents with deadly quiet. It is her conviction that the deadlock of the terrible month of August determined the future course of the war and the terms of the peace, the shape of the interwar period, and the conditions of the second round. He then went on to describe the main actors in the narrative, saying that one of the marks of the superior historian is the ability to project human beings as well as events, and he picked out the salient characters, the Kaiser, King Albert, Generals Joffre and